podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by AOL Music and Spinner.com, where you can get free MP3s, exclusive interviews, and more. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 216 for October 1st, 2009. Listener feedback number 76. This show is brought to you by listeners like you and your contributions. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks so much. It's time for Security Now, the show that covers all things secure and security-wise. Protecting yourself online with Mr. Steve Gibson, the king of security, the guy who discovered spyware, coined the term, wrote the first anti-spyware program, and has ever since been writing great free utilities for all of us to protect us. And for the last 4 years, has been educating us. Episode 216. Hello, Steve.
Hey, Leo. Great to be with you again, as always.
In our fifth year of broadcast excellence.
And apparently no sign of slowing down because the industry keeps throwing new bizarre things at us that are fun to share. So, it's not getting any better. Well, I'm wondering why you're going to Dubai. I didn't
tell you that, did I?
No.
I am speaking at TEDx Dubai, which is a great honor. You know, TED is the big conference in Long Beach. You're down your way.
Right.
They do a franchise, so they're all over the world. They just had one in Toronto, and when Giorgio wrote to me, I don't say his last name because I don't want to mispronounce it. He's Italian, but he lives in Dubai. As a lot of people in Dubai are expats. Giorgio Agagna, I hope I'm saying that right, Giorgio, organized TEDx Dubai, and I'm going to be speaking there on the 10th.
Cool.
So Jennifer and I fly out Tuesday. It's a long flight. I think it's 15 or 16 hours. We'll leave Tuesday afternoon, arrive Wednesday night in Dubai. I can't wait. I've never been there. I'm dying to see it. And then Saturday I speak, and then Monday I fly back, and I'll be here the following week. But so next week it'll be Alex Lindsay doing the show.
Right. I heard lots of things about Dubai. Like, it's got 90% of the world's super tall skyscraper cranes because they had to, like, ship all the cranes to Dubai to make the buildings, the places growing so
fast.
It was
just the desert. You know, and they've just, you know, poured tons of money into it to make it kind of this global business marketplace. They have the world's tallest building, the Burj, just opened. Like, just open, so I'll be able to see that. I'll go up there.
Yes, I think it is. It's just massive money. It's just money.
So I can't. It's gonna be great and really full of expats, people from all over the world. There, it's become kind of this. You know, it's like the marketplace, the global marketplace. People just kind of go there. So you know, this is continuing in my world journeys to see the interesting new places to be. So I couldn't say no. I can't wait.
Yeah, cool.
It's gonna be fun. So should we do the security news before we go too far?
Oh, of course, of course. Many listeners wrote in to bring my attention to Carbonite's license agreement. And I wasn't sure whether we had gotten carried away in talking about the level of security and encryption that they apply. But, you know, they're a sponsor. They have been a sponsor of the show.
They told me, and I'm going by what they told me, that they told me that they used AES 256 on their the local machine and then SSL to upload. Is that not the case?
Well, what's the case is that they can decrypt it.
Really?
And that's what's important is that their license says that if they believe there's child pornography or if they're under a government subpoena, or if they need to for technical support reasons to make sure their stuff is working, they have the ability to decrypt the data. Now, I assumed that because one of the features is you're able to log on from elsewhere on the internet and get access to your backed up files.
Right.
Well, that means that they have to be able to decrypt it and send it.
They must have a key. Yeah.
So anyway, I wanted to make sure that we were clear that you know about that caveat. I mean, the benefit is for a certain class of user, it's transparent and in the background and easy, and it, you know, it protects you from your hard drive cracking or crashing rather. But you know, it is the case that they would have the ability, you know, they have the key, the encryption key used for your data being stored. And a bunch of our listeners who are on the ball, and of course that's right why
on.
They're listeners.
Right on, yeah.
You know, checked that and said, "Whoa, wait a minute, just make sure that, you know, that is."
So I'll correct myself because I went too far. They didn't tell me that. I was just reading into it. But of course,
well,
you're right. They would have to have the key to be able to send you a clear copy.
If you log in somewhere else, then
right.
then they would have to be able to do it. And it's interesting, their agreement says that if you do that, then your data will be sent in the clear. And it's like, whoa, wait a minute, you know, why? I would think that would be SSL encrypted so that it wouldn't transit in the clear. But their paragraph 15 at the bottom does state that if you access your data from another location other than your main machine, then it won't enjoy the encryption that they normally apply.
Hmm.
And so you acknowledge that, you know, you're allowing that to happen. So
yeah, I would check and see if it's HTTPS. It may still be HTTPS. You know how lawyers are. They want to hedge everything just in case.
Cover themselves.
So, you know, and I think probably I would bet they, for legal reasons, do want to be able to respond to subpoenas. But this is, if you're worried about that, that's why you use TrueCrypt or something else where you have the key.
For what it's worth, yes.
You could also TrueCrypt before you upload it if you want.
No, because their system runs autonomously. They explain that they look at the files, they examine the headers. I mean, they're looking into your data on your machine make sure the file size is right, look for
right.
changes. They may be doing checksums or something.
They have to do that. You're right. Otherwise, they wouldn't know if it's new or not. Yeah.
Right. Cause,
yeah.
So they're doing autonomous, you know, in the background work. I'm a jungle disk user because, you know, and we had the author on the show.
Right.
I know exactly how it works, where only I have the key. So Amazon, with their S3 data storage service, they're storing completely pseudo-random data that they have absolutely,
right.
It is completely opaque to them. So
right.
I'm comfortable with that, but it's a more techie and not an automatic solution. So again, I think there's
also more expensive. You pay the price if you have the same amount of data, you're going to pay more. So
I think, you know, there's certainly a class of user for whom Carbonite makes absolute sense. So I think I did want to respond to our listeners who, you know, and make it very clear that, you know, it would take a court order, but that, you know, that can be done at their end.
Well, I learned this week that the same thing is true of Twitter. We had a little incident with somebody posting death threats on Twitter and tried to get the information. I was just hoping I could just send a note to Twitter saying, just tell me if the kids, this person's in California, so I know if I should worry. And they said, no, you can't. You need a court order. So, We contacted the local police. He's getting a court order, but that's how it's. I guess that's how it's supposed to be. I think that's kind of the normal circumstance for most.
Well, and for example, once upon a time, years ago, there was someone who I knew was nearby, sending denial of service noise
at
GRC.
Yep.
And so I could tell from their IP that they were a local Cox Cable customer. And I had some contacts here with the local FBI, and I said, hey, you know, I found these four machines. I'm sure it's not anybody who owns the machine. They just have some
right.
junk on their machine.
Right.
And, you know, and so they had to produce a subpoena to allow Cox to tell
right.
them, the owners of those IPs, and then they called and said, hey, you know, we've got a person we work with who would like to come take a look at your machine. You probably don't know it, but it's infected with some stuff, and wouldn't you like that fixed? And so they said, oh, my goodness, we had no idea. You know, it's funny, too, because the kids were complaining they could no longer burn CDs because the machine was it was so overrun with junk. I mean, it took like an hour to boot because it was the war of the malware. It's like who was going to, you know, play King of the Hill inside the machine just every time it booted. It was a disaster. And they were using Kazaa back in the day. They were like, well, we like free music. I was like, oh, yeah, I bet you do.
Well, very, yeah. And, in fact, I talked to the FBI in San Francisco, too. So.
Yeah.
Because I guess if it's on the Internet, they count it as interstate or a federal thing. just by its nature.
Yeah, well, and in general, I mean, the thing to look at is that these companies that have records, they want to be protected against their customers suing them for disclosing the information. So, for example, in my case, even though Cox would have happily, I mean, it wasn't like they were trying to hide the information, but they have an agreement with their customers to maintain their customers' privacy. So the company has to ask for the, has to literally say, please make us give you this data.
Right.
You know,
right.
They have to ask to be compelled to do it so that they're able then to say to the customer,
privacy.
Look,
you have privacy.
We were subpoenaed.
Right.
We had no choice. And again, for example, that's why this paragraph 15 of the Carbonite Agreement says, if we are subpoenaed, we will turn over your data. Just, you know, FYI. So the top of the news is, for me, very exciting. Yesterday, which is, or day before yesterday, given that the podcast is released on Thursdays, that is to say Tuesday, the 29th of October, Microsoft Security Essentials was released. That's, and you can just put Microsoft Security Essentials into Google, or it's Microsoft.com/security_essentials. And this is the awaited first Microsoft free antivirus and anti-malware scanning and monitoring, you know, overall prevention utility from Microsoft that I'm very excited about. I like the idea that it is small and lightweight. I like that it's from Microsoft, so I have the sense that it'll integrate properly with Windows and won't be in the way. It's not going to be jumping up and down trying to get my attention and reminding me that it's, you know, it's time to you know, re-up my license or anything. All of the reviews that have been done so far have been positive. Having watched it, the one thing I can say is in full system scan mode, it makes SpinRite look fast. It is very slow. Now, its speed is a function of the type of file it's looking at. I've noticed that it just whizzes through a block of JPEG image files. Boy, when it hits an .exe or a .dll or something executable, it spends some time. Now, I think that was the right choice because, first of all, you're not having to do a full system scan all the time. You want to do, I would say, that once when you first install it, because then it's able to look at changes and new things coming into your system and check them incrementally, in which case it's not a problem. The benefit of it being so slow is that it is being thorough and it is not generating false positives. You can imagine with Microsoft being as security, well, as customer support shy as they are, you know, we've talked many times how, unfortunately, Microsoft leaves things turned on by default because they don't want people calling them, asking them how to turn them on. So they're just on. Well, the last thing Microsoft wants is a technology which is going to be generating false positive alerts. And many of the looser, faster heuristic technologies do have the problem of generating false positives. It every few months, you know, our support email starts getting reports that some random piece of my freeware, which hasn't changed in a decade, suddenly has spyware in it. It's like, no, it doesn't.
Do you think there's something about your software that lends itself to that, or what? Why?
No, I hear about it from everybody. Mark Thompson has the same
everybody,
thing happen.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Problem is, these scanners are trying to be very fast,
right,
and they're trying to, you know, they're trying to be sensitive enough, but not too sensitive. Microsoft has clearly taken a different approach where they're, you know, really affirmatively identifying rather than just sort of scanning across the top and saying, oh, look, this might be a problem.
It's a much slower scanner than most. I mean,
oh, it's painfully slow.
Even the quote quick scan is slow.
Like I said, it makes SpinRite look fast.
Yeah.
You know, SpinRite is known for taking its time and being thorough, and this thing is really slow. But, you know, again, you would do the full deep scan, I would say, once upon installing it. Then you can set it up with a schedule, and it is watching your system on the fly. I'm just excited about this because I've got friends who, for the last couple of months, I've said, you know, like someone will buy a computer and say, hey, I got some notice that Trend Micro wants to bill me $39.95. I say, okay, hold on. In a couple months, there's going to be something from Microsoft, which is free. Now, we'll remember that this is only for the client machines, not server platforms. They have their full-strength commercial product from which this is descended for their server platforms. But for all of us running, you know, XP and Vista and Windows 7, you know, here's, I think, going to be a great solution. Now, I've only looked at it at this level at this point. I've got the next 4 weeks of Security Now shows mapped out. So, and in fact, we're going to have John Graham come on in 3 weeks.
Oh, great.
And talk about in great detail JavaScript, which he knows inside and out. And he gave a presentation about it in a recent virus conference. So I said, oh, John, we Leon and I need to have you on. So he's agreed to do that.
Fantastic.
And so it'll be the week after the Q&A following that one, I will have had time to really spend a lot more time, and we'll do certainly a podcast about
it. Do
you
think this is going to put the commercial antiviruses out of business? I can't imagine. I mean, why would anybody? Of course, there have been free antiviruses for a long time, and that hasn't put the commercial guys out of business. But this was Microsoft, you know?
And there really isn't a commercial competitor for Internet Explorer. There are free competitors for Internet Explorer, but not a commercial browser. It'd be hard to sell one, for money. I think this changes the game. I think that Microsoft gave everybody a long run that is in the AV world, but if this is as good as it seems to be, and it doesn't cause problems, and it updates multiple times a day, it uses, you know, the current connected always model. I know that it's what I'm going to recommend to all of my own friends who are, you know, who I just sort of try not to get involved with their computers because I don't want to be, you know, their go-to guy, but they know they should be doing something. And I think this just solves the problem. So I would say if a person has an existing relationship with an AV company, they're comfortable with it, they like it, they've gotten to know it, they know its quirks and so forth, they may be inclined for the sake of inertia just to stay there. But I would be surprised if a new machine started to try to charge you money for the AV that was pre-installed and, you know, for 90 days and then it wants money from you. I'd be surprised if people didn't say, oh, wait a minute, you know, is that what I should do? Or should I just say, remove this and install Microsoft's free one? Before long, then the word will be out that Microsoft provides this. Microsoft has solved this problem. And I think that changes the game.
Yeah. Right. Well, again, good. I mean, who better to than Microsoft?
And I like it because it's lightweight. I mean, now here I am with my cookie manager that the only thing it does, you know, my little permit cookies extension for Firefox, is it just brings up a little lame little dialogue that says allow or disallow. I mean, that's all I want. So I always prefer a tight, minimal solution. And from what I've seen, that's what Microsoft has given us. Because they're not having to compete with the major AV players. You know, I just think I look at, for example, how Zone Alarm or Zone Labs destroyed Zone Alarm by having to compete with Symantec and their Norton suite and had to put everything but the kitchen sink. In fact, I think maybe that's an option in the firewall. It's just they ruined a good personal firewall, and it just became a horrible thing. So, you know,
There's two parts, I guess, to an antivirus. One is the scanner, usually doing that by signatures, right? And the other is heuristics, where it's looking for bad behavior. Does this do both of those?
Don't know yet.
See, that's the problem. We don't know how good the scanner is. We don't know how sophisticated the heuristics are. I'd like to see some tests on that, although it's very hard to test, of course.
Well, a lot of tests have been done.
Oh, they have.
And Microsoft has come out on top.
Oh, good. All right.
I mean, it's like as good as anything else from everything I've seen.
That's all that matters.
I know. I think it's a win. So
where did they get this? Is this a rewrite of OneCare, of the giant antivirus that they bought? Or is this something?
I don't know how to characterize it. Not really a rewrite. It is the engine behind their commercial product.
Okay.
Their mainstream commercial product. And so they spun out this free one after proving the technology. That's like, okay, we got it nailed. Now we're confident that we can, you know, because they recognize that it was going to be a hit.
Right.
You know, they opened the beta and they were providing 75,000 downloads and they closed it partway through the first day because it just everyone went nuts for it.
Yeah.
And you know, I've been waiting for it. I'm excited. I think this changes the game.
Right.
In the same way that for example, that Microsoft having a really good firewall in their products do. Now their firewall does not do outbound monitoring. So some would argue, well, it's not really good because it doesn't do that. But it's like, well, if you're careful about not letting anything in, then you probably have the security you need. And this will help prevent things from getting in.
It makes sense. They'd release this right as it is a couple of weeks before the release of Windows 7.
Yeah.
They've got it now in any pretty much a complete security suite. Windows 7 implements user access control and other security features. It sounds like that 7 might be really the holy grail, which is a version of Windows that just is not prone to this stuff. I hope. We hope.
Well, to hear Paul talking about it wasn't Paul, it was a Mac person who was saying of Windows 7 that this was good enough that, you know, he was kind of finding himself thinking, wow, I could actually use this.
Oh, yeah, I love it. I mean, I'll probably still use a Mac as my personal computer, but I love Windows 7. I think it's the best version of Windows they've ever done.
Yep.
And you know, a thing to remember is that the key really to protecting against infections is widespread antivirus use. It's like vaccination. The more people that are running antiviruses, that damps down the spread of the antivirus, right?
Very good point.
So,
because it is machines that are infected that are actively working to infect others.
Right. So by giving away, I wish they'd install the darn thing. I guess they feel like they can't do that to their partners. But, you know, it should come with this.
Just give it time. This always starts this way.
Right.
And then it'll just be built in. It'll just be, you know, like, look, we've got, you can't not have automatic updates now. You have to fight Microsoft, you know, to get control of that.
And look, a boon Service Pack 2 was for XP because it turned on the firewall.
Right.
That in itself was a huge improvement.
It was everything just to block that.
I think this will be comparable to that. I hope.
I think so, too. This is really big.
Right.
The only other security news I had, it was a quiet week, was just a little tiny mention. This is not a big deal at all. But I know that the VLC media player is popular for a lot of users who like to have a third-party, more format-expansive media player. And there are a bunch of multiple buffer overrun vulnerabilities that exist in everything up to and including version 1.0.1. So anyone using VLC, I mean, again, I don't even think that the attack surface is very big on this. Who's going to, you know, create a piece of media specifically hoping that you're running it under VLC media player? But I just did want to mention that there is an update to that. Otherwise, it's been very, very quiet on the security front. I'm sure in a couple of weeks we will, you know, when we get to the second Tuesday of October, things will pick up and we'll have some more news. But that's it for now.
That's good news. I like that.
But I had one really fun little short SpinRite story that caught my eye. Actually, I encountered it just this morning when I was running through the mailbag looking for our Q&A questions, because the subject was SpinRite saved our lawsuit. And I thought, okay, well, there's one I haven't heard before. And so he asked me to leave his name out if I read this on the air. So he said, hi, but he's located in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He said, hi, Steve. Thought I'd say how awesome SpinRite is. I needed to copy some .pst files, which is really interesting, too, because my homeowner association was sued by a bunch of homeowners who were disgruntled, and all the members of the board were using Outlook. And they all came to me because I'm unfortunately I had been identified, I'd been uncloaked as someone who understood computers, and they were all needing, you know, the attorneys all needed everyone's email dialogues that were related to the last X number of years of their service on the board. And so it's like, oh, okay. Oh, so I had to figure out how to do that. And so he said, I needed to copy some .pst files from the CEO's laptop for some discovery our lawyers wanted. When I tried to back up his main file, I kept getting a CRC, cyclic redundancy check error. After working the lump out of my throat, I tried creating another .pst file to copy the email into, but that failed with the same error. So I pulled out the SpinRite disk. I know management gave me a hard time when I needed to buy four licenses, because the way that works is a single license allows the licensee, the user, to use it on any machines that they own, any machines and hard drives. But we ask people to have four licenses for we call it the corporate site license, to then use it, for example, on all the machines within a corporation. And so he says, but I told them it was worth it and that it is a good product. Thank goodness I was right. After running it on level 2 for an hour, the original file copied without any problem. Thank you so much. P.S. Please don't use my name on the air if you read this.
That's
so
great.
Thanks for the positive feedback.
Good news.
As always.
SpinRite saves the day.
And in an hour this time. Instead of a year.
Yeah, we should mention that. You know, the time varies depending on how bad the drive is, right? What kind of shape the drive's in.
Yes, in fact, it's funny too, because SpinRite continually estimates
right.
how much longer it has to run based on how far it's gotten given how much time it's had so far. So it assumes that the whole drive is going to be exactly like what it has seen so far, which is often not the case. It's very often the case that the drive may have some problems at the beginning, which is why it's, you know, blue screen of deathing and having, you know, can't get booted or whatever. But then after working through those, it just takes off like a bat out of hell. So people say, wait a minute, it says it's going to finish in the year 2020. It's like, no, calm down. You know, it's probably just hit a rough spot right off the bat, right, which has caused it to project its completion time as, you know, not in your lifetime, but as soon as it gets past that, it fixes its estimate and then starts getting much more accurate. Good. So that's good.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get to 10 of your questions. We've got some great ones in just a second, but I do want to mention audible.com. Have you watched the new Flash Forward yet? Are you interested in this show?
I don't think so. I saw the previews and it's like, and I tried to watch Defying Gravity for a while, which was, you know, the summer sci-fi show. And it's like, this is just too much soap opera in space for me.
I'm not a big, as you know, and we've talked about this before, I'm not a big fan of sci-fi on TV. I just feel like they never give it the budget or the time that it needs.
Oh, except for
Stargate. Fringe. I know you
Fringe,
love
Fringe.
And Fringe. No, I will watch that when that comes out on DVD.
It's so fun. And we have a new Stargate this Friday. In fact, I'm glad you
mentioned
it.
Yeah.
Yes, Stargate Universe. I know nothing about it, but it is premiering this Friday, the day after the podcast. So we should let all of our listeners know, I'm sure they do now, that the Stargate Universe, which is, you know, the Stargate franchise I've really, really enjoyed. It's a little cartoony sometimes, but fun. But, Fringe is just always delightful.
Fringe is kind of like X-Files, right?
Yeah, it's very much so. In fact, it's funny, in an episode last week, the premiere episode of this new season, there was a Senate Finance Committee meeting where they were going to cut off the funding for the Fringe division. And the guy said, you know, we've spent so much money in these X-Files and this Fringe division. I thought that was really great.
That's a nice touch.
Yeah.
I like that. That's a really nice touch. I have, for you, in my hands, a passel of questions. Are you ready, Mr. G?
I am.
All right. Starting with Brian Dort from Alpena, Michigan. Brian says he's got some news about PayPal's multi-factor authentication, which we have spent many, many moons talking about. Steve and Leo, I'm another longtime listener since episode 1 of Security Now. Also a happy SpinRite owner. It has saved many hard drives for me. I now have a USB thumb drive with SpinRite loaded on it. Oh, that's a good idea. I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah, Spinrite will set up a USB thumb drive as a bootable drive, and then you can put any other files on that you want to. But when you boot that thumb drive, Spinrite just takes over and runs.
Brilliant!
Yeah.
A couple of years back after episode 103 on the PayPal security key, that football that we talked about, I ordered one for myself and immediately started using it. By the way, just a side note, I gave the football to our business manager, so she has it now.
Good.
She's got the football, like the atomic football. Since then, it's worked perfectly until one recent day, I pressed the button to receive my token and nothing happened. My assumption is the battery died. No worries, though. I can log on to PayPal, answer a few questions, and order another. This time, emulating the master, he means you, Steve.
I think he does.
I ordered three with the intention of placing two in the freezer for future needs. Well, they're only $5 each. Why not?
Yeah.
To my surprise, when they arrived, the dongle was not to be found. Instead, a thin credit card size security key was found. It has a circle that says press on the front, along with an e-ink type of display that shows the number. I'm going to pull mine out because I have the same exact thing.
I know, yep, as do I in my wallet.
Yeah, I know what he's talking about. At first, I thought this was a great thing. It fits in my wallet easily, and I usually have my wallet with me more than I have my keys with me. However, after using this new format for a short period of time, I'm convinced that PayPal's made another mistake. My first one stopped working after about 1 month, probably due to me sitting on the security key while it's in my wallet. The second one continues to work, but one day PayPal wouldn't even recognize it. In fact, when I called PayPal, the customer service rep said it wouldn't work because I didn't buy it from PayPal, even though I did. In fact, their logo's plastered on the front. She sent me the new security key, and I'll try to get this one working. I asked about the football-shaped dongle that used to be available and was told they don't sell them anymore, only these new credit card formats. I hope you and Leo get back to reality sometime soon, okay? I don't know what that means. Can you care to explain? I've been using this, but I got this one. This is the VIP thing that you and I have talked about from VeriSign. So I presume that's what PayPal's now distributing, something like this, right?
Yes. I thought this was interesting. Apparently what happened is that the footballs are dying and the batteries are, as he says, are dying. Now, I have one of each, and I've got the football next to me, which I use every couple of days. Now I'm a little anxious about whether it's going to die, because that would be a problem. Although I do also have the credit card format. Now, remember that the football, I think the problem with the battery life on the football is that it has a clock in it, which is running all the time,
right,
even when we're not pressing the button. Pressing the button basically just causes it to perform a little calculation based on the current time of day and then display the code, which is valid for 30 seconds. And it changes every 30 seconds. The credit card approach has the advantage of consuming zero power, and even when it so when you press the little press here button, it briefly fires it up and it produces an incremental next code, which is not based on time but which is based strictly on a cryptographic sequence. So there's a counter which is driving a cryptographic algorithm based on a secret key which it knows and which the authenticating agent at the other side, and VeriSign is behind all of this. VeriSign is the technology that PayPal uses, and VeriSign provides the gateway. So this is exactly the credit card that we've talked about before. I've never had mine die. Mine's in my wallet, too. When I take it out, I notice that it does have sort of a slight curve to it, and I think, well, okay, it seems to be working just fine. So anyway, I just wanted to apprise our listeners of the fact that that's what's going on, that PayPal has apparently backed out of the football that we've talked about and enjoyed, and in favor of this credit card, probably because it's got a greater lifetime.
Right.
You know, this little clock is running in the football whether you're using it or not, whereas the credit card probably lasts many more years.
I've been sitting on this for a long time. I keep this in my wallet, the credit card, and it's been pretty reliable. So.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah. But we got ours. I guess this is the same. Ours say VeriSign, not PayPal. And you can use it with PayPal. So maybe that's another solution. People might want to go to the VIP program at VeriSign and get that one and use it with PayPal. You can use that one with PayPal, not with eBay, oddly enough.
Yeah, it is odd. I'm not quite sure how they're hooked together.
What PayPal's been doing lately, which I prefer, frankly, is sending me a text message on my phone. So you can add a cell phone to your authentication means and have it, and then when you log into PayPal, it'll say, well, what do you want to use? Your football, the card? I now have three devices, football, the card, or the cell phone, and now I just always say cell phone. Just send me a text message because I always have it with me.
Right.
And that works fine.
Right.
Maybe that's in the long run. In fact, before your football dies, set up your cell phone to do that.
Well, and what's interesting, too, is if somebody were to choose that who was trying to pretend to be you and log on to PayPal...
I'd get a notice.
You'd get a call.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, wait a minute. Why am I receiving a confirmation code from PayPal?
Not much you can do about it. I get at least once a week a French language email from somebody trying to get my Gmail account because my name's French. And obviously somebody thinks that's their account, even though it's not.
Right.
And it must drive them. I'm driving them crazy. I keep sending an email. I never get it. Yeah, because it's the wrong email. I'm getting it. And so it is a warning. But what are you going to do? Question number, let's see. I jumped ahead there. Wait a minute. Hold on. Question number.
That, yeah.
Oh, no, you didn't. You jumped ahead.
I did?
You went from 1 to 4. Unless I've made a terrible mistake. Oh, I see what happened here.
I got a page 2. I mean, I have a question 2.
My pages are all messed up.
Huh.
Question 2, Zane Killingsworth. Is that correct?
Yes.
From Dawsonville, Georgia. Wants help securing a new PC. He says, hi.
Hello.
I'm a young PC enthusiast who's getting a new PC in the near future, and I want help with what security software I should get. Well, I think we now know what the answer is going to be, but I thought I was fine with Norton's 360 until I started putting a lot of files on my desktop and read the book Little Brother by Cory Doctorow. I was so shocked by my lack of security that I tried to put Paranoid Linux on my PC. I didn't know there was such a distro. That's funny. But since the book used a version of it on a future Xbox, I thought that, like almost everything in the book, it was real, but it was just a little startup that died. I guess there is no Paranoid Linux. Since then, I've listened to every Security Now podcast to try to be more secure. Also, very happy to say, because of my listening, I've helped my school. I'm homeschooled and take science classes at my home at a local small school for homeschoolers. I helped them determine that their Wi-Fi network was compromised and helped them pick a new, more secure Wi-Fi router. Yay. So, help me pick a better solution for security, for antivirus, and what other software I need.
Steve? Well, in the beginning of Zane's note, it felt to me like he had gotten himself overly concerned.
Yes.
And so I wanted to address that because I do see that in email and in our news groups, you know, people who really, it's like the concern for security is consuming their life. They're afraid to go out of the house. They only want to do so between the hours of 11 and 1 when they're sure that right. The sun won't set too quickly on them. I just wanted to address that the issue of it being possible to be so concerned about security that you're not having any fun anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this should be fun. All of the evidence indicates that, you know, there are agencies and individuals and groups that are taking advantage of mistakes being made in the design of our computer technology as it exists today for their own advantage and hurting other people in the process. There's a story that I'm going to share next week about a company, construction company that is suing a bank because they feel that the bank's security, the logon security, wasn't good enough, and $588,000 was stolen from their account.
Wow.
As a consequence. So, I mean, these things do happen, but you really do want to keep some balance, I think. The idea of not using Windows in favor of something called Paranoid Linux. I know that there are people who enjoy being this focused on security, but I wouldn't ever promote the notion that it's necessary to be this focused on it, because you still want to be able to have the freedom to do what you want to do. I mean, it's a little bit like you, Leo, having a problem with no script or like turning scripting off. You know, there we're sort of in a gray zone. You know, you need to be able to see sites in general that you're reviewing running the way they're meant to by the bulk of the population who do have scripting on, whereas I and many Security Now listeners have said, wait a minute, I need a little more control. I'm going to turn scripting on selectively. When I notice that there seems to be something wrong, then I'll permit a site to operate. Mm-hmm. So, again, you could have somebody who refuses to ever run scripting, but then arguably sites that you need or want to use won't work at all. So I'm thinking, okay, compromise. You know, yes, unfortunately, scripting is a mixed blessing, but it's one that we need. So anyway, I just sort of wanted to respond to Zane's, you know, he uses the word paranoia and say, look, you know, don't get yourself too scared about this. You know, I hope that we strike a balance here during this last 216 podcasts of saying, look, here's the issues, here's the facts. We want to let everyone decide for themselves what's, you know, where they fall in this spectrum of really concerned and not concerned at all.
It's very easy to get paranoid about this stuff.
Which, and, not surprisingly, takes us to our third question.
And by the way, just to answer his question about what security package, I think it's pretty clear from our conversation at the beginning of the show that Microsoft Security Essentials would be the right choice.
Yes? Until we know otherwise, yes. I don't want to say anything until, you know, the jury's in,
right,
or out or back or wherever the jury's going to go. But, yes, I have high hopes.
So far, so good.
Yes.
John in Ontario, yes, this is the next one, says, Ontario, California, by the way, says, we're so silly. Steve and Leo, we have been using Mac OS 9 since 1998 with an open IP address. We are now on OS 10. We have 12 Macs on this via Verizon, each with its own public IP address. Always have for over 10 years now. We have no protection of any kind, yet have never, ever been hacked. I think all this paranoia about hacking is just that. Paranoia, and you and Leo just propagated the fear factor. And furthermore, why would any of us need your advice? After all, we're not harboring nuclear secrets or planned attacks on some geographic location. Would you two just get real? Wow. I'm hurt.
Well, there's the other side of the spectrum. I thought it was...
That's kind of head in the sand.
This really anchors both ends.
Yeah.
Well, I first of all, I would comment that OS X has a firewall, and it's turned on. And so you do have automatically protection from incoming threats. You know, he's obviously not behind a NAT router. He says he's got individual IPs for each of the machines, and so each machine has a public IP, and it's out there on the net. Well, and that he's been doing this for, what, the last 10 years? I think that's great.
I would liken it to somebody who say, I never go to the doctor and I've never had any vaccinations and I'm just fine. Until you're not.
Yes. And here I am saying yes, but if you take a little vitamin D every day,
right,
the statistics show that you have much better prospects for the future.
Right.
And
you're fine until you get hacked. And then,
Yeah, it absolutely is the case that these problems are real. If you put a Windows machine on the net with its own IP with nothing protecting it, it will get commandeered. You know, security researchers do the experiments. There's just so much junk on the internet. Now, it's true that he's in a better position with Macs than he is with PCs today. But we know that that's also a moving target, that as Macs become more popular, we're seeing a greater incidence of acknowledged potential problems with Macs. So
I should point out, though, that if he had done this with a Windows 98 machine, he would indubitably been hacked at this point. Yes?
and may not have known it.
May not know it. It may be now. We don't know it.
Exactly. I mean, it's difficult to say. It's clear. You know, we talked last week about what's the relative security of different OSs, and agreed that they're all soft. They're all softer than we wish they were. They've all got problems of different nature of problems, different sorts of problems. You know, the open source model has some. The closed source model has its. They're different, but fundamentally, complex software is going to have a problem with security, and complex software is what we have in all of these systems today. You know, John's got very sophisticated software in his systems. So I don't know really how to respond to him, except that I would feel, with everything I know, extremely uncomfortable with machines that weren't behind a NAT router, that weren't behind, I'm used to it. I know how that technology works. I like the idea that it's protecting me from the outside. I know what's out there. Am I paranoid? Well, it's certainly the case that millions of machines, Windows machines, were infected by the Conficker worm. I mean, we absolutely know that. It's taken down whole systems of hospitals over in England. And, you know, that's not illusory. That's real. And we've, you know, people are having their machines infected by their actions as they click on links in email all the time. I mean, I've on several occasions, I've had to spend a long weekend scraping stuff off of people's machines. And in some cases, there was one, a female friend of mine from Starbucks about 6 months ago, I referred to it, that I just, you know, I looked at it for a while and it was clearly just beyond recovery. So I formatted the disk and set it up for her. And she's now using Eudora and Firefox because I decided, okay, let's try to prevent this from happening again. So these things really are out there. I'm glad John hasn't been bitten by one yet. And I hope if it does happen, it's not bad, because, you know, he clearly believes that, for some reason, he's listening to the podcast, but he believes that we're a sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I don't think that's the case. We happened because of the need, not creating the need.
I wouldn't feel too defensive. And in his defense, and it's kind of like we talked about with the last question, there certainly is, it can happen that people listen and go, and just feel terrified and become an agoraphobic. And we're not trying to do that either. I think the idea is reasoned information about the risks, and you be the judge. First of all, we should say we gain nothing. Neither of us make a security program that we sell. We gain nothing by you being afraid. We don't work for an antivirus company. I'm not the security expert Steve is, but I'll speak for you, Steve. I mean, you know, you're just getting the information out there.
Well, and I really do think we maintain a balance.
This
is not the go screaming for the hills paranoia.
And I'm the guy who says, yeah, what the heck, I'm not. I'm going to run scripting. I'm not going to.
And the fact is, today on a Mac, you're safer than today on a Windows machine.
Oh, yeah.
There's no doubt about it.
No question about that.
Yeah. Yep.
Bob in Connecticut wants to know if we have seen and have had a response to an article. He says, I'm a longtime listener, love the podcast. Have you seen anything on this one-time password being defeated? Here's a link to the occurrence I read about. The title of the article, it's on technologyreview.com. Is that the MIT Technology Review?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, that's a good journal. It's, the title is "Real Time Hacker Foils to Factor Security."
And a person who we both know as an author, Leo Robert Lemos. Wrote the article. So this is MIT's Technology Review magazine, and I wanted to highlight it because, first of all, it's really interesting, and it's a perfect topic for us to discuss, and many of our listeners are apparently reading this or saw the link and said, hey, you know, what about this? Because we've talked so often about the strength of multi-factor security.
Right.
And so the subtitle is "One-Time Passwords Are Vulnerable to New Hacking Techniques." Hmm. And so Robert Lemos writes, he says, in mid-July, an accounting manager at Firma, a construction firm in Mountain View, California, logged into the company's bank account to pay their bills, using a one-time password to make the transaction more secure, that is, to log in. Yet the manager's computer had a hitchhiker. A forensic analysis performed later would reveal that an earlier visit to a different website had allowed a malicious program to invade his computer. While the manager issued legitimate payments, the program behind his back initiated 27 transactions to various bank accounts, siphoning off $447,000 in a matter of minutes. Quote, they not only got into my system here, they were able to ascertain how much they could draw, so they drew the limit, said Roy Ferrari, Firma's president. The theft happened despite Firma's use of a one-time password, a six-digit code issued by a small electronic device every 30 or 60 seconds. Well, we know what that is. Online thieves have adapted to this additional security by creating special programs, real-time Trojan horses, that can issue transactions to a bank while the account holder is online, turning the one-time password into a weak link in the financial security chain. Quote, I think it's a broken model, unquote, Ferrari says. Security experts say the banks and consumers alike need to adapt, that banks should offer their account holders more security, and consumers should take more steps to stay secure, especially protecting the computers they use for financial transactions. Quote, we have to fundamentally rethink how customers interact with their banks online, says Joe Stewart, director of malware research for security firm SecureWorks in Atlanta, Georgia. Quote, putting all the issues with the technology aside, if attackers can run their code on your system, they can do anything you can do on your computer. They can become you. So I'm not going to read the rest of the story because we've got the gist of it. So what happened was that an infected machine went online, and the software that was clearly sophisticated enough, it used the fact that a one-time password had authenticated the session, the logon session, to, and then this is amazing to me that this is, I mean, it's clearly possible, but, you know, that this manager would happen to have software that understood how to perform transactions behind his back using the credentials that he had, the transient logon credentials that he had established. I mean, it's chilling. And so, again, I would say to our prior questioner, Joe in Ontario, California, who thinks this is all paranoid, that, well, this stuff really does happen. So it's interesting because the title for next week's podcast is already The Fundamentally Broken Browser Model.
Oh, boy.
Because, you know, that's what we'll be talking about when you're in Dubai, Leo.
Oh, boy.
Because there was another presentation at the Black Hat conference recently in D.C. that I hadn't been able to get out of my mind because it talks about breaking SSL, and it really doesn't do that. It leverages the fundamentally broken model of using a web browser for these sorts of things. And that really is the problem. For example, if there was more granularity in the security transaction, for example, if you not only had to use the one-time password to log on, but you had to use it every single time you performed a transaction, well, then this particular breach would have been prevented because this breach was hijacking the user's current state, their logged on state, and performing this work at the same time in the background that they were doing other things with their bank. But this does highlight the level of sophistication that we've now arisen to. I don't think this, I would be a little less harsh in criticizing multi-factor authentication, except that this does say to us, if this is the level of sophistication, then we need to push multi-factor authentication even closer to what we're trying to authenticate. The problem was, this was being used to authenticate the session. It's clear that in the presence of this kind of malware, we need to authenticate the transaction and get closer to, you know, what it actually is we're trying to protect. We're trying to protect the transactions, plural, yet, and so we're assuming that the fact that they're wrapped in an authenticated session provides that protection. Well, this demonstrates that assumption is no longer valid. Now we need a per-transaction authentication, which is a little more annoying, but if you've got the football right there, and you want that level of protection, you know, if the bank said, do you want to authenticate per transaction or per session, now you know, you say per transaction, I want to challenge every single time I do something.
I suppose there's still a window, though, even if you're doing it per transaction. I mean, as long as there's 30 seconds, if their system is, you know, quick enough, they can sneak in there while you're authenticated.
Yeah, I have to think about that, whether something could, I mean, it would be authenticating, you need something at your end that the malware couldn't get to that was tied to the details of the transaction. So you were basically, something, you provided the details of the transaction, then the other end said, okay, I need you to sign the details of that transaction in a way that the malware could not sign its own transaction, which would be different from yours. So there are certainly ways to do this. But again, it's like, whoa, this clearly ups the ante.
Yeah. Very interesting.
And it's done. Malware out there, we now know, is becoming that good. And so it does say, what the article went on to mention was that banks needed to provide consumers, you know, with, like, secure computers. It's like, well, okay, how's that going to work? not clear how we get there from here.
It just shows how determined and clever bad guys are.
Well, and this does set me up. I didn't, you know, I ran across this in preparing today's Q&A, but I mean, this sets me up for next week's discussion of the fact that, unfortunately, convenient as it is, remember, this all kind of happened to us. You know, we had browsers that were going to allow us to, you know, look at static websites, and then it's like, oh, well, we can submit information. We can use, you know, forms and the get and the post commands to send stuff back.
Yeah.
Suddenly now it's interactive, and then the banking said, oh, we really don't want to see you, so because it's expensive for us to hire tellers, so we're going to automate all this and put this online, and besides, we've been told that SSL is safe. Well, yeah, SSL is safe. You know, I mean, well, we know that there are caveats even there, but so the problem is this notion of using something as convenient as a web browser is really broken, and next week we're going to talk about some very clever approaches that demonstrate how broken it is.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Question 5, Jacob Theobald in San Francisco. He wonders about the security of Internet Explorer tabs. Oh, I'm sorry. No, of the IE Tabs Firefox plugin. That puts IE in Firefox.
Right.
Recently, by the way, I don't know if you saw this, Google put Chrome inside of IE, saying IE is never going to support HTML5 well enough for us to use Google Wave, so we're just going to put a plug-in that puts Chrome in there. For people who want to keep using IE but not give up Firefox, this is the same in the other direction. Hi, Stephen Lee. I've been wanting to ask this for a while but never got around to it. I've been using this IE Tabs Firefox add-on. From the looks of it, it can switch a specific tab to use the IE engine to view web pages, if you're in a case where you need IE, like Windows Update, for instance. Could any security vulnerabilities that affect IE affect Firefox through the use of this add-on?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This is exactly like the problem of using the HTML viewer, which is IE,
right.
In Microsoft Outlook email. You know, the infamous preview pane where you just select the email and it comes up in the preview pane. That's all it takes if you happen to be viewing malicious email for something to get a foothold in your machine. The idea is that, and this is Microsoft's whole, it started with Olay and became ActiveX. The idea is that the application has become basically sort of a window, literally a window frame and controls surrounding the code which displays the content. So what essentially what Firefox is doing with the IE tabs add-in to Firefox is doing is it's instantiating, creating an instance of the full Internet Explorer viewer that just happens to be wrapped with Firefox's borders and controls and window dressing rather than IE's. But it's in no way more secure. It's sort of the lowest common denominator approach. So yes, I can see the appeal, and my advice would be use it as little as possible. Use it for Windows Update and only for websites that you trust that won't run in Firefox. You know, I have IE, even though I'm exclusively using Firefox now, I use IE to run Windows Update, and that's it. And very rarely I'll see some site that just is really badly written that absolutely requires IE. And I mean, I call it badly written because, you know, they're really restricting themselves to a subset of the Internet. You know, Firefox is increasing its market share all the time. And for good reason. So,
yeah. Yes,
it's absolutely, you are vulnerable to all IE vulnerabilities if anything uses that IE ActiveX control, whether it's email or any other browser who says, oh, look, you get the benefits of both. It's like, well, and the liabilities of both.
Right. Of course, IE is always running on all Windows machines. So, you know, that's why, you know, if you look at HTML, email, or anything, it's always there. The engine's always there. Hard to get away from it.
Moving right along to our
next. It's not in my system, Leo.
How do you get rid of it?
I use Eudora, which doesn't use IE at all.
Yeah, but IE, if you've got Windows, the rendering engine is there at all times, and it's kind of hard. I'll give you an example. It's kind of hard to know when it's being used. Quicken for a long time from Intuit, and may still, for this matter, would embed an IE window inside its Quicken, so that you could see online data from the Intuit website.
Yep, and in fact, there have been programs that will say, requires Internet Explorer version 6 to be installed
right.
in your machine in order for something entirely non-web browser-y
right.
to work, because they're relying on that component. So anyway, I wouldn't say that it's always running, but it's certainly the case that that it has the ability to pop up literally when you're not expecting it.
Yeah, it's almost always right, Donald. Well, okay, I'll give you another example. When you're using Explorer to explore the hard drive, and you enter in a URL in that Explorer window, it will then open the web page.
Yeah.
Isn't Explorer, I mean, I don't know what the difference is, IE and Explorer.
Well, they're very different. So
it's just the rendering engine just says, oh, never mind, I'm going to use IE instead to do this.
Right.
Okay. They're different programs.
Right.
But they have a direct link.
They do.
Donald Burr in Santa Maria, California, has some feedback to our answer, should I run my own server? Remember, we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. In fact, he says, in your listener feedback 2 weeks ago, in your listener feedback number 75 episode, you answered Dax Mars' question. I love that name, and I do. He says that, and I love it too. About running his own server at home, your response recommended going with the most secure distribution of a Unix-like operating system, and specifically mentioned NetBSD or FreeBSD. While I agree with the overall concept of shying away from Windows, I would instead recommend that he goes with a Linux distribution specifically one based around Debian's package management system. There is, for example, a version of Ubuntu specifically tailored for servers that would be ideal for this. One of the most important things that a person as a server administrator needs to do is to keep up on software updates. I'm sure you'll agree with me on that. However, unless I'm mistaken, updating a BSD system is difficult and involves having to rebuild the kernel, user space tools, etc., and even for an intermediate level user can prove to be a daunting undertaking. Debian-based distributions, on the other hand, have a very easy way of upgrading the system involving only two shell commands, apt-get update and then apt-get upgrade. These two simple commands will download the latest version of all Linux tools, including any third-party programs you may have installed, like Apache, the web server, or the MySQL database. The Debian and Ubuntu folks are very proactive when it comes to incorporating the latest security fixes into their packages. Just my two cents. Love the show. Love that SpinRite has saved my bacon on more occasions than I can account. So that's a good point, but there'll be a debate over this, I think.
I think it's a very good point. Well, you know, the issue of OS is religious. You know,
yes.
Everybody has their own for their own reason. And so I wanted to share Donald's recommendation, and I don't disagree. I mean, I've used Debian Linux, and I like the packet manager that Debian has. And obviously, Ubuntu is a very popular solution as well. So, you know, one thing that I might add is that for a non-Unix or Linux user, someone who's moving from Windows, all of this stuff is a lot less obvious and easy to use than Windows is. And so one thing that may, I mean, I guess I feel a little bit like it's six of one, half a dozen of the other, except if you've got some friends who have a bias or experience, it could ease the transition a lot to say, well, you know, what are you guys using? I'd like to use the same thing so I have someone I can call when I have a question.
Right. Yeah, that's of course true. I think it might be Randall Schwartz who prefers, he says, the most secure network operating system is NetBSD, or I can't remember.
Well, and that takes us into question number seven.
Oh, well, let's move along then.
OpenBSD. Randall says OpenBSD. He's in our chat room because he's getting ready for a Plus Weekly.
Then he's going to like question number seven.
All right. Donald. No, that was Donald. This is Bob Carname in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. What do you have against Theo? Okay. I should have read that. Just listening to the latest episode, 214, at one point you recommend running a web server on the securest version of Unix available. I certainly agree with that, especially versus any Windows OS. But you only mentioned NetBSD and FreeBSD. What about OpenBSD? A little while ago I did research on what OS to try to use for some applications where security is particularly important. I eliminated Windows, I eliminated Mac OS, and I eliminated Linux. I don't think I need to explain any of that decision-making process. I thought about Sun's offerings, Solaris, I guess, but decided that since I'm a Mac guy, I probably have an easier time acclimating to one of the BSDs, Berkeley System Distribution. I read the mission statements for the big three. FreeBSD is all about getting everything to work, lots of applications ported to FreeBSD, lots of device drivers, that sort of thing. NetBSD is mainly about working on anything. You could probably install it on an abacus, he says. Finally, OpenBSD claims itself to be, among other things, secure by default. That last statement caught my interest. I read about what they claim to do, or try to do, especially and strictly formatted code that makes it easier to audit, and auditing code for correctness and security even before a flaw or exploit is known. That's the attitude I was looking for and wish everyone had, and I didn't see any reports that OpenBSD was not doing as they claimed, so I'm going with it. It's a little more difficult to do certain things, but I, like probably most Security Now listeners, understand that it's necessary to give up a little bit, sometimes a lot, of convenience for the sake of security. I don't consider that a hardship. The classic example is that when you enable Apache in the default install, it runs chrooted. So does Bind, by the way. So creating dynamic database-driven websites takes an extra bit of planning and work. Anyway, I'm not associated with the project other than as a user, and I don't know Theo, who Theo, by the way, is the guy who wrote it. But so far, I think OpenBSD is great. Should I maybe not? Is their claim of proactive security all hype? What have you heard? Should I panic? Arg! Thanks.
Well, It's interesting because his comment parallels some dialogue that popped up immediately in the GRC news group, the Security Now news group, saying, hey, wait a minute, what about OpenBSD, Steve? Why didn't you talk about that? And again, it's just a matter of familiarity, which by no means means I wanted to slight OpenBSD. I just ended up first using FreeBSD, and that's where I'm comfortable. And I've looked at NetBSD and just sort of haven't gotten around to OpenBSD. I haven't needed to, but I absolutely wanted to give its due and its moment in the sun. So, and apparently Randall Shortz is a OpenBSD advocate, yes, also. So that says a lot for it.
We've had this conversation, Randall and I, and I think that, I'm trying to remember, and I've asked Randall, but as I remember, there have been two exploits total since BSD, OpenBSD was created.
Which is a phenomenally low number.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So that kind of obviates the whole need for patching. And remember, patching's, if you've got exploits, you got to patch, but patches, as frequently as not, I think, introduce other exploits. So patching isn't the magic panacea either. It would be
patching patching is something that unfortunately we've all become abused into accepting, but it doesn't. I mean, you'd much rather have something that didn't need it,
right,
than something that was like, oh, look how often we're patching, aren't we wonderful?
Right.
Like,
right.
Okay.
Patching can just introduce new problems.
Absolutely.
So OpenBSD, I think that everywhere I've heard, that's kind of everybody says, yeah.
Yep.
Oh, it's true. Theo's got it right.
So by no means did I mean to exclude it by having just said, when I did, FreeBSD or NetBSD, OpenBSD.
Right. Emil in Denmark, our question number 8, found an overlooked feature in TrueCrypt. Hi, Stephen Leon. I think I found a feature in TrueCrypt you have not previously mentioned in Security Now. TrueCrypt, settings, preferences, more settings, system encryption. When pre-boot authentication is configured, the login screen says TrueCrypt bootloader and asks you to enter your password. But with this menu item, you can change this however you like so that no text appears at all. Or you can write a short custom message such as, I like
love
this one, missing operating system.
Ah.
I guess you could even write your password as a message in case you forget it, but that's not a good idea. It could still be technically possible for an attacker to prove that TrueCrypt is installed in the drive, but I think this is a cool feature, perhaps even worth mentioning in the show. What a great idea.
I thought it was so clever. I mean, all of us who have used computers for a long time are, we see our life path before our eyes when you boot the system and it comes up missing operating system. It's like, oh. What now? Or, and sometimes you'll move a drive to a different machine and it'll be, it'll be a primary on one machine and a secondary on the other. So there are various reasons you can get that. But frankly, if I turned a machine on and it said TrueCrypt bootloader, I go, oh, okay, now I know
something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, where no one is endorsing security through obscurity, this isn't that, because you still have all the security that you would have if it loudly proclaimed itself to be TrueCrypt bootloader, but instead you've just sort of thrown everybody right off the scent,
right,
by saying missing operating system. I was like, oh, it's like, don't even bother going any further.
There's a difference between security through obscurity and not giving people more information than they need. That's why you say stealth your ports.
Right.
Why volunteer information? Why volunteer that TrueCrypt's installed?
In fact, I have a buddy who's got his Wi-Fi router's SSID set, the beacon that you can see whenever you browse Wi-Fi in your area. He has it set to NORAD missile command or something.
Now, that could go both ways. That might encourage somebody to try to break in.
I just think if someone says, oh, crap, I'm not going to touch that. They're going to get me.
Yeah.
So I just like missing operating system. That's classic. That's just beautiful. I wanted to give Emil a little nod of the head for that one.
That's really good. Bobcat in our chat room says his TrueCrypt login, boot login, is NT loader is missing.
That's
another good one. Make it look as much like the real thing, right? Paul Dove in Hampton, UK, question number 9, our penultimate question, is using WAN router administration. Well, we were talking about disabling that, and we said, well, who would use that?
Who would ever want that?
Ever. And in fact, he's quoting you from episode 214, saying, quote, "It's very distressing, Leo, if there are still routers that have WAN admin on. I mean, nobody needs it." Well, Paul says, "I have three routers connected in a Y with a WPA router on one branch of the Y." This is what we talked about as the way to do WEP securely.
Yep, the ultimate Wi-Fi security.
He's got WPA one, WEP router on the other, and then they are connected, the two of them, to a third router. He says, "I only have the WEP router so my kids can connect their Nintendo DS." That's exactly why you do it.
Yep.
"I would never want to connect any PC to this router, so I have it set to WAN admin so that I can change settings by accessing it externally. But I'm still behind the router and firewall at the base of the Y. And when I'm accessing the settings this way, I don't think there's any way data could get from the WEP device to my main WPA network. Am I safe?"
I thought that was a really interesting and great reaction.
Yep.
Yes, he is certainly safe. What you don't want is the internet to have access to your WAN admin, because without other provisions, there's nothing to prevent someone from just pounding away on its login trying to get in. But here, he's got WAN admin on one of his internal or interior routers, so that he's able to access it from outside of the WEP protected network, but still inside his own local area network, because that's inside the router which is interfacing that Y to the internet. So yeah, I thought that was a great reason, and he should be completely comfortable with that. There's no way bad guys can get to his WAN interface, and certainly no way anybody on the WEP side can get to it either. So it being enabled is fine, although you definitely want to make sure that you've got a very strong password on your LAN side login for the WEP router, because we know how broken WEP is, and so by catching some packets while your kids are using their Nintendo DS, they would be able to get the WEP key, and that would allow them to try to log in to the WEP router on the LAN side using the web interface. So you would absolutely want to protect that.
Yeah, I mean, it's already more broken just because it's using WEP than WAN administration, right? I mean,
right.
Yeah.
Right. That's a very good point. That's a good way of looking at it. That's the bigger concern than the WAN side being exposed, which is only exposed internally. So I thought that was very clever.
Good. Our last question. Steve from Dave and Max in the UK, and they want to know, can we watch Security Now after it's been broadcast? I know you guys broadcast it live. Yes, we do. We do it every Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern.
Actually, Leo, that's right now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
11 a.m. Pacific, which is 1800 British standards, actually British daylight time. But is there any way I can watch the episode after it's been recorded? We're in UK, so due to the time difference, we're unable to watch Security Now live. I'm sure other listeners would like to watch live after it's been recorded, so keep up the good work. Well, I have good news on that count.
This was one for you, Leo.
And we're kind of pre-announcing it, so it's not ready yet. Right now, the way we do Security Now, we do record it live. And as with all our shows, you can watch that live recording. You know, think of it as a spy cam into my studio, although it's a little fancier than that. we, in fact, replay it again and again later in the day. So Wednesday evening and Steve. Steve's playing with the camera now. Wednesday evening. And Thursday in the early morning hours, you can probably catch it with other shows being rerun. But that's not very satisfactory. So some of our viewers have for the last year been capturing the flash and putting it on their website with our permission and encouragement, odtv.me, odtv.me. So you can, in fact, go back and watch reruns there. But we're about to announce in a couple of weeks at Blogger, we're going to announce this.
What?
We're going to offer video of this show and our top five shows, and then slowly roll out video of all the shows, both for download on iTunes or, whatever you use for your podcatchers, the Zune. You can watch it on the Zune HD. That will be one way you can get it, but we're also working with a company called MediaFly. They're going to put it on the Roku box. I know you know about the Roku Netflix player. So you'll be able to watch us. This is a pre-announce, I probably shouldn't even say this, but I think you'll be able to watch both live or after the fact, so on that Roku box. And then we're going to slowly roll it out on a lot of platforms. And my hope is, my plan is that on whatever platform it rolls out, whether it's your portable phone, your television, your TiVo, whatever, that you'll both be able to watch what's currently live or what was live so that you have kind of the choice. You can either, it's like on demand or live. So that you would be, Dave and you, Max, you'd be able to go there and you'd say, well, I missed the live broadcast, but I want to see it again and be able to press a button and be able to watch it. Now, Roku's not available in the UK, so, but this is coming your way soon. And we're rejiggering everything to make this possible. We're spending a lot of money. We have to get a SAN device. We're going to change all of our editing from just audio editing to audio and video editing and Final Cut. We've had our squirrels, Colleen and Eric and Tony, working like crazy to get this ready. And we hope to have it ready in the next few weeks. So we'll let you know when that is available. But yeah, this will be, I'm pretty sure this will be one of the shows that we roll out right away. I can't remember what the list is, but it's certainly on the list.
Where is Security Now in the ranking? Because once upon a time, Twit was number one.
Twit's number one.
We were number two.
This was the second show. No, I think it's Twit, MacBreak Weekly, and Windows Weekly in a close tie.
Okay.
Net at Night and Security Now in a tie for a third place. And then Twig, our newest show, is now, I think, in third place.
Wow.
It's going up very fast, yeah.
And that's this week in Google?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's because of the subject matter, but also because of our hosts. We have Gina Trapani and Jeff Jarvis are so good and have lots of fans in their own right.
She's neat. I saw a replay of that. I'm thinking, okay, who is this and what show is this?
She created Lifehacker. I mean, Gina is like, you would love her. She's a programmer. She's a productivity guru, just a great person. She lives in San Diego, kind of down your way.
She's neat.
Yeah. So it's my goal to do two things. I think in the long run, I mean, the audio podcasts are what got us started, and they still pay all the bills. But in the long run, it's my goal to create a 24-hour kind of CNN for geeks that all of our shows will be part of and additional shows, you know, almost 24/7, as close to that as we can get.
And would always there be live streaming, or could it be that you would end up just being download on demand shows?
I want to keep doing live streaming because I think that the idea of being able to just go somewhere, press a button, and whatever's on, you watch, and that would make us more. For instance, in about 20 minutes, we're going to check in at 1 o'clock. We're going to check in with the New York Times and see what they're working today. So I want to have a live kind of network that, you know, whatever's going on, you're always kind of apprised of what's right now. Because people like live.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we realize that if you do it live, everybody's gotten conditioned to being able to TiVo everything on television. So we've got to make it, you know, some way for you to be able to get the stuff after the fact. So we'll make it, that's really what's going on here. That's why we're doing
I think it's perfect. It sounds like it's those bases are covered, Leo.
Well, it's a project. It's quite an investment financially and in terms of manpower. You know, there's now 7 full-time people working here and a goodly number of part-timers. So it's expanding very rapidly. But I won't ever be as big as you. You are the cautionary tale on getting too big. I don't ever want to be so big that I have to go to meetings all day.
And no, especially when your meetings have meetings.
There is a staff meeting now in about 15 minutes, however. We now have a staff meeting. Of course, when you say all hands, we can fit around a small round table, so it's not so bad.
That's good. Well, we're going to talk next in 2 weeks, since you're going to be in some big highest building in the world in Dubai, when Alex Lindsay and I are talking about the fundamentally broken browser model.
Ooh, that'll be fascinating. And then I'll be back in time for Q&A number 77.
Yep, and then we're going to do a really neat episode about the innards of JavaScript and fundamental problems with our friend John Graham Cumming.
The creator of the Geek Atlas.
Yeah.
He's the guy, too, and we interviewed him on Twit, who got the apology from the British government for Alan Turing's prosecution. Really neat guy. Love
Very
John.
Cool.
So that's going to be fun. I can't wait for that. Steve, always a pleasure. Don't forget, Steve's at grc.com. That's the place to go to get your copy of Spin Right. and all those free, wonderful utilities that Steve is just cranking out all the time. GRC, that's short for Gibson Research Corporation, GRC.com. And if you go to GRC.com/feedback, you can give Steve questions for future episodes.
Please do.
Yeah. And you can also get 16 kilobit versions of this show for the bandwidth impaired. Full transcripts and show notes, too, there, as well as on our wiki, wiki.twit.tv, and our friend feed conversation pit. That's friendfeed.com/twit-conversation to follow along there in real time. And our chat room. Let's not leave that out, as long as I'm giving you everybody irc.twit.tv. Steve, we'll see you next week. I won't, but everybody else will see you next week.
Thanks, Leo.
Security now.